Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Foley-Love, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to today's In Conversation event with Jessica Matthews. Ladies and gentlemen, Jessica is one of America's leading scholar policymakers, if I can put it that way. She has an incredibly impressive resume. In the late 70s, she worked on President Carter's National Security Council at the invitation, I think, of Zbigniew Brzezinski, whom we lost recently. She served on the editorial board of the Washington Post. She was a columnist for the Post. She worked in the Clinton administration. And then most prominently, perhaps, she served as president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace for 18 years, stepping down in February 2015. And 18 years running a think tank is a long time. I've been doing it for 6 years, and probably my colleagues are hoping that I don't hit the 18-year mark. But I know everybody. Was aware of the great successes that the Carnegie Endowment had in your period, including opening up all those centres around the world and really becoming the global think tank. So, as a little think tank in Australia that nevertheless has global interests and global aspirations, we're very happy indeed to host you. Let me also say that we all try to look at the world from different perspectives, and each of us brings our own interests, but not many foreign policy analysts look at the world from the perspective of a molecular biologist. And Jessica holds a PhD in that subject. And in fact, I'm told that John Kerry once described her as the Stephen Hawking of public policy. Is that true?
It was true. He said it was not true that it's not true. But
so, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jessica Matthews. Well, let's dive right into it. I thought what we might do is have a conversation, Jessica, for 20 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up to the audience. And what I wanted to talk to you about was the role of the United States in the age of Mr. Trump. So perhaps we can start at the most recent sort of marker points, these two summits that we saw in the last couple of weeks. First of all, the G7 summit, where we saw these really quite striking photographs, for example, of an isolated Mr. Trump surrounded by a number of other Western Democratic leaders, and then a very contrasting summit in Singapore with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. So what did you take from the combination of those two summits?
Well, let me answer by giving the context in which I look at it. Number one, the National Security Council, right, a year ago was told that they should make their memos for the president shorter, 3 pages to 1 page. Later they were told shorter still, and it would help if you would scatter the word Trump in the 1 or 2 paragraphs that you have left. This is a true story. This was a memo to the staff of the NSC. And more recently, they were sent another memo that said it would help if you could describe or deal with some of your issues pictorially. So ask yourself, think of a foreign policy issue, the U.S. role in Asia, right? The JCPOA, the Iran deal, 150 pages. How would you draw a picture? How could you do anything helpful? So my point is, this is a man who does not read, and also a man who does not like to be lectured, which is how he perceives briefings. So, and a man who has no knowledge of history. None. When he heard from the South Koreans this invitation, and the words, the magic words, North Korea is prepared for complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, he thought it meant something. And he did not know about the 8 agreements that the North Koreans have signed since 1992. that use this word and what we have learned through painful experience they mean by it. I think the outcome of this summit, there are only two possible explanations of it. One is that in the 3 months between when he took the invitation and when he had the summit, he learned nothing about what I just said. And the other is that when he left, he actually knew he'd gotten nothing. And this was, and when he said on Air Force One on the way home, this could have been done years ago. And then when he tweeted the next morning, there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea, this was more of the con job script by which we are governed now. And, you know, he talks about fake news all the time. This was fake diplomacy. And the notion that something happened in Singapore and Secretary Pompeo is now going to fill in the details is nonsense. And we've seen it enough to know that Trump governs with one guiding principle in mind, which is this good for me? It's not a question of long-term U.S. interest or short-term U.S. interest. It's Trump interest. And he is something of a genius at pursuing. You have to have a certain kind of personality that is not at all troubled, even subconsciously, about telling lies and about putting your own interest above anything else. So, long answer, I'm afraid. And in fact, day before yesterday, Secretary Pompeo did announce that he had, quote, no timeline for this filling in the details phase. Whereas when they left Singapore, he said we would see major disarmament by the end of Trump's first term. So I think it's very transparently clear that nothing happened there. And except that, it's better that they're talking than that they're exchanging threats.
Is it not possible, though, even if we accept that Trump is an unusual character, that he's prepared to lie, that he's prepared to declare victory when obviously no victory has been won? Is it still not possible, though, that we might not be surprised? I mean, because Kim Jong-un has surprised us in many ways. He's been, first of all, much more ambitious and aggressive in terms of his programs. And then he's pivoted towards a pretty kind of effective use of soft power in some sort of ways. He seems like a more impressive statesman than we might have thought a few years ago. So is it not...
A few months ago.
Yeah. So if it's changing that quickly, is it not possible that even if it's not really to do with Mr. Trump or it's not his because of Mr. Trump, is it... Should we allow ourselves to keep open the possibility that something good might happen in terms of North Korea's nuclear programs?
I don't think so. They have been working on this program since 1962, so more than half a century. They are still technically at war with the most powerful country in the world. They are, as you all know, so reclusive, and they have such an effective a propaganda machine that it feeds paranoia. The massive destruction that they suffered in the Korean War is in the minds of many living people. For all these reasons, I think that they are, that the chances that they would give up their nuclear weapons is, and I seldom talk like this, very close to zero. Lots of countries have given up nuclear weapons programs, many, and four countries gave up nuclear weapons that they either inherited or received from somewhere else, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Canada. But only one country has given up actual weapons, and that was South Africa. And they gave them up almost certainly because the de Klerk apartheid government did not want to hand six nuclear weapons over to an incoming black government. And that was a very unique situation. They did it right after Mandela had been released from prison and after the African National Congress had been debanned. So it's a very rare event, right? And I should say that you referred to last year, their pattern has been to ratchet up pressure and tension and then step back and see what they can get in negotiations. Actually, often the secret programs go on even during the negotiations, but they do that and then they take a breather and they do it again. And, you know, he got to the point at the end of 2017 where he had tested a hydrogen bomb and he had tested an intercontinental ballistic missile that can reach the United States. That's a pretty good place to pause. As far as we know, the only major technological threshold they still have to surmount is, do they have reentry vehicles that can protect the missile warhead coming back into the atmosphere? That we don't think that they have achieved. But they've come a very long way in 2017. It was a natural time to take a breather. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he made that clear in his New Year's Day speech. But your point, could possibly he have changed? I mean, I think for all those reasons, and including that this was the dream of his father and his grandfather, the likelihood that the changes we've seen, which have been dramatic, extend to the nuclear program, I think, is just infinitesimal. And but just to say that I agree with you that he looks like a whole different guy since, well, 2018 than he did. I mean, this is someone who never met with a foreigner except for his Japanese chef and Dennis Rodman, the crazy basketball player, in 6.5 years in office. Never left North Korea. Certainly, obviously, never met with another head of state or another senior official. And now, all of a sudden, 3 trips to China, 1 trip to South Korea, you know, to Singapore. He's just, but I don't think it, perhaps I'll be happily proved wrong. I don't think so. I mean, just to take one other example, the first step towards disarmament, or even a freeze, is verification. The first step to verification is you got to tell the international inspectors everything you've got. South Korea has never even acknowledged that they have nuclear weapons facilities or sites or materials at more than one site at Yongbyon, ever. And to our knowledge, and I don't know how incomplete our intelligence is, they have at least 16 sites. So to get from where they have been and where they are now in terms of revealing what they have to where they would need to be for you to sign any kind of meaningful agreement is just, you know, mm-hmm. It's a leap to the moon.
To come back to where I started, the tale of two summits, yeah. What did you make of the difference in atmospherics? On the one hand, after the G7 yeah. meeting, Mr. Trump's advisor said that there's a special place in hell for Justin Trudeau, the head of one of America's closest allies, Canada. And yet, Mr. Trump said he had a special bond with right. Kim Jong-un. Right. We know that, as you've written about in the New York Review, for many decades, Mr. Trump has had a sort of a strange affinity for strong men and a distrust of sort of pesky liberals and Democrats. What do you make of this, and what does it mean for the Western alliance when the person in the cockpit of the most important country in the West doesn't really believe in it?
I don't know what the right adjective is, but he has made it very clear that he attaches zero value to American allies, to alliances. And, you know, when you compare, the United States has 59 defense alliance, formal alliance relationships. China has two, North Korea and Pakistan. Who would you rather be? You know, even if it's just a mere, if it has nothing to do with values and nothing to do with history, even if it were just a mere reading of power, raw power, and yet he seems to place almost a negative value on alliances. And nobody can explain this, I don't think. I mean, it's bizarre. And I spent several days on this trip at a meeting in Canberra. And I must say, I was, first of all, I had a kind of an out-of-body experience hearing my country described the way I'm describing it, but by others. But to hear as many people as I heard say, we can't afford to wait around to discover whether Trump is an aberration and a, you know, short-lived interlude or the beginning of something else, we have to start hedging, we have to start changing, broadening our security relationships and stuff. I guess I was assuming others were going to tread water for a little longer, but I can understand it completely. I think that everything that we have built for 70 years, through many different fights and different, you know, neocons versus liberal internationalists and stuff, but everything that is common to all different brands of U.S. international policy is at risk, and or is being actively dismantled.
Well, let me ask you about that. You know, what are your thoughts on whether Mr. Trump is sui generis, and this is a very Trump-specific phenomenon, versus the product, the beneficiary, and the instrument of much greater impersonal forces that will continue to last? And how much of your answer to that question depends on whether he serves a full first term or indeed a second term?
Well, if he serves a second term, it means that the American people reelected him. And that means that our country is very different from what I think it is and from what 60%+ of people I think it is. So it would also give him an awful lot of time to dismantle things. You know, what we have seen is he's very good at tearing things apart. And tearing things apart is really not that hard. You know, as anybody's worked in government, you know, you can sort of, you can dismantle things, but building things, building trust, building relationship, building agreements, building especially multilateral ones, is long, slow, hard work. He has made no deals. You think about it. Nothing. The famous deal maker, he has not made a deal in 16 months in office. And he has done nothing really on the domestic side either. He is unable to sit down with Republican leaders in Congress and say, let's develop a strategy and to stay on the same position from Monday to Tuesday. And I'm not exaggerating. So I do think part of how much of damage is done depends on how long he stays in office. To give you one example, which I learned here. We do know that one of the things they are doing, very quietly, subterranean stuff, is not filling vacancies and ending terms on very important commissions and councils that are key part of our system. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, the Federal Election Commission, which oversees campaign finance, none of them now have a quorum. They have big staffs, but they can't act. They can't do anything. They're stuck. What I heard here 2 days ago is that they are vetoing all new appointments to the dispute resolution board of the WTO, and that by the end of this year, the WTO will be unable, the dispute resolution mechanism will be unable to function because it will be below quorum too. So, you know, he makes so much front page news, you know, much of it crazy and meaningless, Melania's jacket and stuff. But there's more news that can get covered of serious damage that's being done both domestically and internationally to the institutions that make a democracy work and that make the Western Alliance work.
Let me pivot slightly and ask you to reflect on the Obama administration's foreign policy now that we're a year or two away from it. I mean, some critics would say that President Obama contributed in some way to the situation we're in, where large numbers of American people are open to an argument about retrenchment, an argument for retrenchment. Some people would say, some muscular liberals, some, and many conservatives, of course, made this argument back in the day, that he had an insufficiently large conception of America's role in the world. He was not committed to playing a large role as a custodian of the liberal order unless US interests were directly engaged. He didn't see, you remember the great scandal about when he said that Americans are no more exceptionalist in a way than Greeks or Britons, that he saw America in some sort of way as more of a normal country in terms of its role in the world, and that he accustomed, he sort of accustomed Americans perhaps to a situation where you could have a president who says, those things don't matter to us. We're never going to send our troops to die for some half-submerged water feature in the South China Sea. Now, of course, now that we look back on Obama from the position of where we are, he actually looks pretty good. But is there something to that, that Obama himself, either perhaps as a result, because he was being influenced by the same forces that contributed to Mr. Trump's election, or because of his own intellectual position, was he mistaken in arguing for a smaller role for the United States in the world?
I think he was, but I don't think it explains what happened, because I think if it really had been reaching Americans, would have been the opposite. That is to say, make them more. That the criticism, which I think is valid, should, if it really had percolated out into the general public, made people feel that we ought to be doing more rather than less. Mm-hmm. But I do think that he made a terrible mistake with not reacting on the South China Sea in 2010. 11 much more vigorously, much more, you know, the Pentagon reached the conclusion that what China was doing was not strategic, that we could wipe out everything that they had done in a minute in a conflict, but they missed the point that it had a symbolic importance that quite apart from that, that ought to have been confronted, and that it opened the door to other kinds of behavior. What I do think, Michael, that is hard for me to understand is that Obama made the rest of the world think the U.S. was retreating much more than it in fact has. Mm-hmm. You know, if you travel to the Middle East and talk to people or listen to people there, you think, my God, the U.S. has pulled back massively. And then you go and look at the number of troops we have, the facilities we have, the commitments we have, the activities we're doing, and you think, we haven't retreated one whit. The pivot made Europe feel abandoned and not because of what actually happened, but because of the word. Because you can't pivot without turning your back on somebody. And Asia, because of the South China Sea and other things, I think, also feels that even before Trump, right? So here in three major regions of the world, all feeling that the United States has pulled back and is no longer a reliable ally. And when, in fact, I think if you just look at realities on the ground, it hasn't. And that has to be put down to a message that Obama sent that was incorrect. Plus, I think some real mistakes. The mistake in Syria with the red line on chemical weapons, the mistake in the South China Sea, these were important errors.
All right, I've got a lot of questions for Jessica, but I want to give people in the audience an opportunity to ask questions too. So please put up your hand if you'd like to ask a question.
My name is Cosmos. My question is just about this notion of hidden forces that are putting the wind behind Trump's sail. Can you characterize what that actually is, who they are? We hear about Republicans that are pro-Trump, against Trump. We hear about business leaders, titans of business that are pro-Trump, others that are against Trump. What are the characteristics? Is it based on race, IQ, social position, domestic factors, international outlook? What actually gives Trump his merit?
He has managed to take over completely the Republican Party, 100%. He has a 90% approval rating in the Republican Party. At the same time, the membership in the Republican Party has fallen in this 1 year from 32% of the American population to 28%. Not a winning position. But because his approval rating among Republicans is so high, in our system, the first step in elections are primary elections, when if you're a Democrat, you're running against other Democrats. If you're a Republican, you're running against other Republicans. So the elected Republicans who hate what he is doing have to worry about a primary challenge. And so far, everybody who has criticized him in the Republican Party has been defeated in primaries. So they have every reason not to be brave, not to stand up. And we didn't see anybody who was not retiring stand up until this latest appalling business with the separation of children and parents from migrants, when a few people who are still running for re-election stood up and said, this is more than I can tolerate. But by and large, the Republican Party is now a totally spineless, indentured servant to Trump. The business leaders originally welcomed him with open arms because they expected corporate tax cuts, which they've gotten, and massive deregulation, which they are getting. What they did not expect was the weirdness on trade and the kind of jerky policy stuff. And in the case of sort of individual CEOs, they were enough appalled by his racism last summer after this business in Charlottesville that all the people who had signed on to these presidential blue ribbon committees resigned, and the committees had to be disbanded because nobody wanted to be personally. He's really bad for business, right? And so lots of people, lots of businesses have had to sort of protect their brand from him. So there's some growing buyer's remorse among business leaders, but to among the general population, the key metric that distinguishes Trump supporters from non-Trump supporters is fascinating and scary. It is whether or not you have higher education. There is a 23-point, I think it is, difference in advantage for Trump opponents among people who have tertiary education. And then he has a great advantage among people who don't. This is bigger than age, and he's disproportionately popular among older people, and bigger than gender, and he's massively unpopular among women. So we now have one of our two parties that is effectively anti-higher education. And if you can think of a worse thing for a country in the 21st century world, I can't. It came out of nowhere, this. So it's not urban, rural, it's not rich, poor, it's education.
Let me ask you about, let's turn our spotlight onto the Democratic Party for a second, and think about the Democratic Party in the age of Trump and what impact his presidency is having on that party. We saw, obviously, Hillary was unable to, although she won the nomination, she was unable to generate enthusiasm among large swaths of the Democratic Party, and Bernie did. We saw overnight a couple of upsets, a remarkable upset in New York, where a real party outsider, a young woman, defeated a long-term Democratic congressman who was in line for leadership, more senior leadership positions. But also in Maryland, I noticed where Ben Jealous, former head of the NAACP, won the primary for Maryland. So what do you think is happening in the Democratic Party? Do you think that in response to these general factors and Mr. Trump himself and all his actions, the Democratic Party appears to be moving to the left? All right, that's the first question. And internationally, I'd like to hear from you too. The new generation of Democratic leaders, are they going to accept the sort of the received wisdom of U.S. foreign policy? I mean, are you going to have American presidents in the Democratic presidents in the future who would be in favor of something like TPP?
Okay, so first, you cited two very recent and perfectly real examples that would suggest that the party is going towards the Bernie wing. But if you look at all the special elections since through 2017 and until now, the primaries have overwhelmingly picked centrists. And even when this was really hard to do because you have such a huge range of candidates, and so it's, you know, when you have, say, five or six or seven Democrats running against each other, very easy for somebody to sneak in from way out there on the fringe. But by and large, they have been highly electable centrists, massive numbers of women, and veterans, which is brand new in the Democratic Party in the last 40 years. Which I'm thrilled about. I think the Iraq and Afghanistan vets are, first of all, running, which I think is terrific, because right now our Congress has virtually nobody who has, I think it's 7% people have served in the military, which is not healthy. And the Democrats, you know, the Republicans since the Vietnam War really have owned defense, military issues, and therefore patriotism. And the Democrats have had nobody who knows how to talk about, who knows how to feel comfortable talking about and positive talking about the military. So all of a sudden we have massive number of these young vets from Iraq and Afghanistan who are running as Democrats. So I think it's very clear the party has not turned towards the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing at all. On your second question, I'm not sure, right? We have to remember that Hillary abandoned TPP in the campaign. I think she should never have done that. I think she should have stood up and defended what she believes. But what will be left after this period where everything that we think we know about American interests and values has been thrown, you know, up in the air? I don't know. I can tell you that there is basically nobody in the American foreign policy establishment outside of the administration itself who supports what he's doing, either on trade or with respect to allies or position in Asia or anything. And these are people who go from, you know, the opposite ends of the ideological spectrum. You just can't, you can't find it.
All right, who else would like to ask a question? Yes, I'll take this gentleman first and then the gentleman behind him.
Thank you. Lieutenant Commander Steve Wall, Royal Australian Navy. I just want to ask about Trump's attitude to NATO, because it's interesting. He talks about the deal. He sort of talks about NATO as if America is underwriting security for the rest of NATO, and this is a really bad deal, you know, and he wants to change that in some way. Is that what he genuinely believes, do you think? Or is that a negotiating tactic? And if he does, if that is what he believes, what do you think that says about the will of the American government at the moment to support the rest of NATO in the event of an Article 5 situation?
I think he genuinely believes it. He's entirely transactional, right? It's not just what have you done for me yesterday, it's what have you done for me today. And it is certainly true that people from the left and the right in our system have been saying that the other NATO members have to spend more. And he hears that and says we're being screwed. And he has said it to one thing you know with him, when he says things over and over and over, he comes to believe them. Because remember, he's not reading. You know, there is nobody in this room who doesn't read more in a week than he's probably read since he became president. You know, we all thought, as appalling as he was in the campaign, that the Oval Office would change him. You know, that the feeling of sitting behind that desk and realizing, you know, that you have the future welfare, not just of 370 million Americans, but of the world, would change him. And it didn't at all. At all. Anyway, I'm sorry to get off the topic here, but is there support for that? No. No.
Good afternoon, Mike Gordon. You mentioned Trump's drive in about, and I think the word you use is a genius, in doing what's best for him. You also mentioned the uproar in the United States recently about the separation of families at the border, and that sparked what was a pretty rare political retreat from Trump because of the damage it was doing to his brand. In the foreign policy space, Trump has proved himself pretty willing to sell anybody out and anything out to achieve what he's after.
Right.
From the rhetoric that's come from the administration, do you foresee anything, or can you, or would you like to predict anything that might have a similar effect in the foreign policy space as the controversy that has occurred in the domestic space? Is there anything that you can see happening in a foreign policy space that would cause Trump to walk back from his willingness to sell out his allies, change his mind, achieve anything? Because we've seen him be willing to endorse and accept things like the annexation of Crimea. Obviously, it happened before he was president, but, you know, endorse that sort of activity. Is there anything you can see anyone doing short of an armed attack on the United States that would stop him from pursuing that what's best for Trump line?
No. I mean, it would have to be something that 70 or 80% of Americans say in their gut, this is wrong. This is not who we are. And except maybe an Article 5 situation with a close ally, maybe that fits, but I think it's unlikely. It generally happens more, I mean, I give you the what is for me that was so telling. I was a very, very strong opponent of the Iraq War, and I could never believe how the American people bought what was such a fraudulent set of reasons for doing this, and then what was such a pathetically awful aftermath. And Bush was slowly losing popularity, but not much. What killed him was the response, the non-response to Hurricane Katrina and the destruction of New Orleans. Why? Because people could say to themselves, I understand this. Okay, I know, I feel that I can judge whether this was a bungled, lousy job, whereas they don't feel that they could judge that about the invasion of Iraq. And I can remember once I was on Oprah in a debate about whether we should go to war in Iraq, and this one lady stood up and she said, everything you've said is so compelling, makes so much sense, but I have to believe the president knows more than you do about this and that he knows what he's doing. But she doesn't have to believe that about New Orleans, right? And so I think the possibility that something would happen on the foreign policy front, that the American public would feel entitled to judge as wrong, and where 80% of us would feel the same way, I can't imagine what it would be.
Just on that topic, I've got a couple of questions, but let me ask just a quick one. How do you think Mr. Trump would react to a terrorist attack on the homeland?
I don't even want to think. I mean, he would, whether it would be effective is completely different. But, you know, when you can lie the way he does, and I don't think any of us have ever seen anything like this before, and just keep going forward, he can bungle things in a huge, huge way, as he has on, I could name you 50 issues, and it doesn't stick.
Brendan Thomas Noon from the United States Studies Center. One of the other orders that the United States helps uphold is the nuclear non-proliferation regime centered on the NPT. And we've seen Trump systematically more or less attack that as well, tearing up the JCPOA, the North Korea deal, which you discussed earlier in the talk. What are the long-term implications for that regime and that order after 4 years of President Trump? What are the long-term implications for non-proliferation?
Well, so far he hasn't done anything about the non-proliferation regime per se. He has done this stupid move about the Iran deal, JCPOA. But he hasn't taken on the regime, you know, broadly. So the question is, what will be the long-term consequences of the destruction of that deal? And will it be destroyed, or will France, Germany, Russia, and China decide to say, well, we're going to go forward without the United States, and Iran be wise enough to stick with it? I doubt. So the long-term consequences, if Iran goes back towards some kind of overt move towards nuclear weapons, I think Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and possibly Egypt, if it could afford it, will follow suit. And then the regime is gone. And, you know, that was always the most important threat from the Iranian program. And because if you don't like stability in the Middle East today, think about it with four nuclear weapons powers. But what would happen? So, you know, that's the thing that matters. But beyond that, he really hasn't gone after, because he doesn't care enough, any sort of multilateral regimes or treaties per se. Because he doesn't even, I don't think he really knows enough to, you know, whether he has heard of the NPT, I don't know.
Well, we might want to keep it that way.
Yes, yeah.
Yes, madam.
My name is Bessadetta from St. George Bank. The US president gets two terms, and I realise that the legal structures in the US and political structures are quite different to some other countries, but we have seen recently, like in Turkey and China, where the leaders have, changed structures so that they could stay in power for longer than two terms. And I guess what I worry about is, given that Trump is so good at dismantling things, and given that it's all about him, do you envisage that he might go down that same track, even though it seems quite hard to do at this time?
Would he like to? Yes. Can he or will he? No. I really do believe we have found a boundary where I think the U.S. institutions are solid. He has made a couple of quote unquote jokes. About one deciphering Trump hint I can give you is when he makes jokes, he's saying what he thinks. And then somebody tells him that he can't say that, and he says, don't you understand it was a joke? He would love to be a dictator, and he would love to stay in office as long as he'd like to. But that's one place, the U.S. system. The thing that you asked that I think is the thing that ought to keep all of us awake at night, or at least Americans, you can understand, you can make a case for why he was elected. In some ways, I think it was almost overdetermined. But what is, I think, impossible to understand is that his support has stayed like this. 15 months. It's just unbelievable. There's almost nothing he can do. And you remember he said in the campaign, I could go down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and my supporters would still support me. And he was right. And you know, what is it that, how do you explain that? I can't explain.
And how does that affect your understanding of the United States, Jessica?
It says to me that the damage that's been done over 35 years of widening economic inequality was deeper than the Democratic Party realized, and that the fear that uneducated, that is higher education, people feel about the United States approaching being a majority-minority country is profound. And I don't know, I know what the policy steps are that you would take to begin to reverse the inequality, but I don't think there are policy steps that can reverse that fear because it's demographic, it's there. I mean, I think all the fight that we're having about immigration is a metaphor. It's not about immigration. It's about becoming a majority-minority country. And because, weirdly, the angst about immigration is inversely proportional to people's distance from the border. People who are living on the border are much more tolerant and much more comfortable with the amount of immigration that we're having. That, you know, in the middle of this craziness over the separations, he went to hold a rally in Duluth, Minnesota, which is like 5 miles from the Canadian border, where there are no Hispanic immigrants. And he had everybody
massing along the northern border of the United States.
Right. So he had them all chanting, build the wall, build the wall, build the wall. So I think it's, as I said, I think it's a metaphor. So there's no question in my mind that by far the most serious threat we face is not foreign. It's domestic. It is our domestic polarization and dysfunction as a result. And how we walk out of what looks like a cul-de-sac, I don't know.
I might ask you, I'm going to take the last question as well, only because I don't want to send everybody off in a cloud of gloom. What do you think, what makes you optimistic about your country? You mentioned, for example, on the Democratic side, you're pleased to see more women running for politics, more veterans running for politics. What are the other trends that, or who are the individuals, if you like, that make you feel positive and optimistic about the United States?
I don't think it's individuals, and I'm not sure it's trends. I do think still that there are, I think many of our institutions have been attacked and are weaker now than we thought they could be, but many also are strong. I mean, you know how negative I am, but when I'm asked, could Trump run for a third term? The answer is no. I don't have any, you know, doubt that it can't go that far. So there is solidity there, and there is a place beyond which our system won't tolerate interference. I am optimistic that he is making people think twice about what we value in being American, and that it has to be fought for. The people who are turning out to run in unprecedented numbers, nobody pushed them to do it. Nobody gave them money to do it. Nobody recruited them. People of character and of achievement are pouring out into the political system. And so there's more health there than, but once they get to Congress, good people become less good in what is now a really bad system. And we were talking before we started about the very bad news that Supreme Court Justice Kennedy is retiring, and we will now have and in our system, the Supreme Court sets the rules in so many critical ways. The most important damaging thing in our political life was a Supreme Court decision some years ago that set new rules for campaign finance, so-called Citizens United. But I guess an optimistic story is that he will be revealed to be a crook, which I believe he is, with no moral core whatsoever. And that means that he will have done things that the system can't tolerate. I believe that. But that people will have been frightened by this experience to realize how vulnerable the system can be to a demagogue, to a true demagogue who can't, and also to take a second look at the divisions in our country. I am mindful that I'm trying to end on an optimistic note, but I don't know how you go about, you know, there are polls that have been done about, what would you care about more if your daughter married somebody of a different religion or a different political party? You know, a few years ago, different religion was up there. Now it's political party. I mean, we have become tribal. And the only way history tells me, and maybe you know, but to fix that is to have a great leader. A great leader. And if we could bring back FDR, we could. That's what we need.
See, Jessica knows how to pull my heartstrings by mentioning FDR. And for those of you who missed it, yesterday the FDR Library released an amazing piece of footage of FDR walking, which is the clearest and longest bit of footage that exists, 39 seconds, of what it looks like, what it looked like for Franklin Roosevelt to carry out this elaborate operation of appearing to walk when in fact he couldn't walk because he didn't have use of his legs. And perhaps that's a good metaphor to end on, because we know the United States has been counted out many times. We know that it has immense staying power, And it does actually have the ability at critical moments to produce leaders of great character. So I'm going to grab onto that bit of optimism, and I'm going to hope that the next few years might be one of those moments. Ladies and gentlemen, we've had a powerful critique today of the Trump